Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thank you very much indeed, Eve. I feel still rather a new girl, so I might bring a wealth of experience and expertise, but it's not necessarily in palliative care. But as a result of generosity of many people, including some people in this room, I am learning fast. I want to take us forward and talk about the future of end-of-life care. As Eve said, actually, end-of-life care has made huge strides over the last 5-6 years, which is great. It is in the middle of delivering the strategy, but actually it also needs to make sure that it adapts to what the needs are likely to be in the future, and that's going to be the focus of my talk. So what I wanted to do was to focus, as I say, on the future. And I suppose one thing that I reflected on when I started with Marie Curie was where palliative care had actually come from in terms of it had come from meeting the needs of patients, particularly dying of cancer. And many of the people, the experts, the people we all look up to with such expertise in palliative care came from a cancer background. And the reason at that time was that treatment of cancer was so much less successful than it is now. And I suppose the first thing to highlight, and I'll bring it out during my talk as well, is that what we need to do is to make sure we can adapt to providing the same high quality of care for people at the end of their life who haven't had cancer. Because obviously one of the great successes of modern science is that more patients are now cured with cancer. And yes, they may have long-term problems as a result of a treatment, hopefully not too many, but some of them certainly do. But nonetheless, the need is perhaps reducing in cancer, and we really must remember other diseases. So when I go around Marie Curie hospices, it's very clear to me that most of the patients there are patients who have cancer and are dying as a result of that. What we need to do is to be able to adapt so we can look after all the patients with complex needs who have end-of-life care issues. So looking at deaths, you can see on this graph, the deaths are in pink and the births are in black. The total number of deaths are set to increase year on year by 17%. And in about 30 years' time, unless the population changes radically in terms of birth rate or there is more immigration into the UK, then deaths will be more common than births. So we have a very obvious problem here. As soon as you look at it, you can see that actually there are going to be more people dying. And although, of course, many people who die don't have specialist palliative care needs, many of them do. So there is an increasing demand for what we all do. And if we look at the age range of deaths, you can see that again, between 2010 and 2030, there's a particular rise in those deaths over 85. And it's really quite a dramatic increase, as you can see on that graph. Now, the important thing about dying over 85 is you're unlikely to only have one condition, one illness. You're much more likely to have what we call multimorbidity, so a whole range of different conditions. And obviously things like dementia, cardiac disease, respiratory disease, maybe you've had a stroke, maybe you are blind as a result of macular degeneration. You'll have a whole host of different conditions, additional conditions, as well as perhaps the thing that you need your end-of-life care needs organised around. And so we need to be much, much better at looking after a whole range of different conditions which the patient is suffering from. We can't call in lots of different people to provide that care. We need in the palliative care community to make sure that we can do our best to look after the whole patient, which means that we need to upskill ourselves, I would suggest, to be able to look after more problems. And a very good example, I think, which is already an issue for us at Marie Curie is dementia, because obviously dementia is becoming much more common. And I found that staff quite reasonably don't feel as confident as competent as they would like to be in looking after patients who have dementia as part of the package of problems they have. And we need to make sure that we address that. This graph, as I said, shows how many disorders you're more likely to have. Now, I'll have to confess to you, I'm 58. So actually, I'm doing pretty well because I haven't got any morbidities at the moment, but clearly lots of 58-year-olds do. So you can just see how they radically go up over time. It's rather a depressing slide, actually, depending on the age you are. And then the other thing, of course, around having lots of different problems towards the end of your life is that you are more likely to need to go into hospital. And if you look at this slide, you can see the costs of social care, which remain fairly static in the last 12 months of life, and the rapid rise on that red line in the costs for inpatient stays. And that's because patients in the last year of life, the older they are more likely to be admitted to hospital. Now, nobody wants to go to hospital, and again, we all know that in the palliative care community. Nobody wants to go into hospital, and yet, because of the multi-morbidity shown in the last slide, you are more likely to need to be, or you are more likely to be admitted. The question is, do you need to be admitted to hospital? Now, what about where people want to die? Now, I know that Marie Curie in particular has very much promoted, rightly, that most people prefer to die at home. We did a YouGov poll in 2008 showing that 63% of people would prefer to die at home. But I suppose I would like to raise a note of caution there, because actually they were people like us who don't expect, hopefully, to die in any short time. We're unlikely to die, hopefully, in the next few months or even a few years. And I think, and what I've recognised perhaps when we're thinking about end-of-life care, which I know many of you share this, is that your view about what you want varies depending on your age, your closeness to what you think might be the end of life, and the sorts of problems you're having as a result of the illnesses leading to the end of life. So Irene Higginson did a piece of work showing that only 49% of over 65-year-olds wanted to die at home back in 2003. And I think this is because they will be very aware of the potential burden on their loved ones. They'll be very aware of whether symptoms can be adequately controlled at home. And so their view about where they would prefer to die is probably different because they are closer to when they need to think about this. And it's just to make sure that we're all aware of this need to look at preferences, but look at preferences in the round and recognise that they may change over time. And if we were to put ourselves in the shoes of our patients or put ourselves in the shoes of the relatives of our patients, I think we can absolutely understand why those preferences might change. In North Somerset, where they've got an EPAC system, only 47% of patients prefer to die at home, 33% in a hospice, 29% in a care home, and 1% in hospital. And I'll come back to hospital as being the least preferred place in a moment. But we also have to remember that the place of death is not people's top priority. It is important, but it's not the top priority. So being with your loved ones and having good pain control are the absolute priorities. And again, I think if we put ourselves in our patients' shoes, we can absolutely understand that. The other thing which we have to be aware of is that the patient's view and their carer's views are different. And I think this work shows this very nicely. So the excellent National Survey of Bereaved People showed that 82%, so these are relatives of patients who've died, the bereaved, 82% of people responded, said their loved ones died in the right place, and 85% had been involved in decisions about their care as much as they wanted. Now, you know, all of us, again, in the palliative care community should be patting ourselves on our backs, really. This looks like a good result. But actually, only 44% of the actual patients had been able to express a preference about where they wanted to die, and only 71% of those wanted to die at home. So the question I suppose I would like hanging in the air is perhaps we don't give the patients the opportunity to express where they would like to die. And of course, if we leave it too late in the course of their illness, then they won't be able to give us their view about their preference. But we need to be aware, I think, when we're providing care, that there is this discontinuity, if you like, between what the patient might be thinking and what the carers might think. And going back to my previous point about, you know, if you're an 80-year-old man or woman who know you're near the end of your life, you've got perhaps a wife who's the same sort of age, you don't want to be a burden on your wife. You therefore may prefer to die in a hospice or even a hospital or care home. And so we need to make sure that we're flexible enough again to pick up those different views so that we can really respond to what patients and hopefully carers need and hopefully marry those two things up together. So where have we got to? Well, we have made a small amount of progress in dying at home because, as I say, a lot of people still do want to die at home, and they will always want to die at home, and we need to support them doing that. But between 2004 and 2010, including the period where the strategy was being implemented, there hasn't been a huge increase, as you can see. Yes, it's now around 21%, but given the demographic changes, you might expect to be, and also the investment in end-of-life care, you might expect it to be much higher than that. So we still have 55% of people dying in hospital, 21% at home, as I said, 18% in a care home, and 5% in hospices. But just coming back to this point about, is home always the right place for people to die? Pain control was rated the worst against hospital, hospice, and care home. So we're not good at controlling pain, and yet we know that as well as being with your loved ones, pain control was one of the most important things for patients. It was one of the top three priorities in those studies that were done. So it looks as if, although people want to die at home, really, we have a responsibility to make sure that the quality of care they get at home is as good as it would be in a hospice. And I think Jonathan will be picking up on some of this in his talk after mine, because what we've perhaps not done enough of is ensuring that home care is as good where it can be as hospice care. Obviously, there are certain patients who need the specialist nature of hospice care and even the specialist nature of hospital care. But are we doing enough to actually make sure that we meet patients' needs in terms of quality of care when they do die at home? What we do know is that hospital is people's least preferred place. It's a bit depressing as I come from a hospital background. But this is what patients and their carers consistently say. They really don't want to be in hospital. But, of course, some people will always need to be in hospital when they die because they die suddenly, they die acutely, or their care can only be delivered in a hospital setting. So, again, I think just picking up this issue about where we need to put our focus going forward, how can we improve quality at home, what can we do? And there is a lot of work already going on, but more needs to be done. What can we do to improve quality in hospitals as well? The problem for patients is that in hospitals, patients were shown dignity and respect all the time, only in 57% of cases by doctors and 48% by nurses. In hospices, it was 87% and 80%. So the figures are considerably higher in hospices. And again, I think we have a responsibility to make sure that we do what we can. Reading the Francis report is obviously a very depressing experience, but we need to do what we can to try and improve those figures and work with our colleagues in hospitals to do something about that. Nursing care, availability of personal care were also rated lowest in hospitals. So we are focusing on dying at home. We've done a very nice piece of work which was done before I started, so I can say that without any sense of bragging, looking at what we can achieve with our Marie Curie nursing services. I would emphasise that this is what can be achieved if we have really good community infrastructure and community services. So it's not just about Marie Curie, but we looked at the Marie Curie patients. What we looked at was 30,000 people who were cared for by our Marie Curie nursing service. Obviously, we have access to that data. And we got the Nuffield Trust to do a piece of work to match those patients with similar patients in terms of diagnosis and age to look to see what happened to them over the same sort of period as we looked after our 30,000 patients. And if we look at that, of the 30,000 people cared for by the Marie Curie Nursing Service, 77% died at home and 8% died in hospital, whereas the matched control group, 35% died at home and 42% died in hospital. So you can see that by having a really good home service in the community does allow more people to die at home, and those figures, I think, are very stark. We also found in the work that patients were much less likely to be admitted acutely to hospital. So 12% of the Marie Curie patients were admitted as an emergency. And often at that stage, as you all know, they're admitted as emergency because people panic. People don't feel that they've got the right support they need. So only 12% of patients under our care were admitted as an emergency versus 35% of controls. And I think one of the worst ends for people would be to be rushed into hospital and then die suddenly in hospital. So I think those emergency admissions are usually failures barriers in what we collectively do in healthcare to provide a dignified death for patients. As I say, this was looking at our patients because that's who we have data for. The same or similar results, I'm sure, could be achieved using the same sort of services as we provide. So I suppose I just wanted to finish on a couple of points. The first is that end-of-life care preferences are complicated. And I think that we have a responsibility to recognise that complexity and to make sure that we champion flexibility as well as all the other things that we champion in terms of a good end-of-life. The second thing is that we need to be skilling ourselves up to be able to look after patients with multimorbidities. Cancer is still important. It will always be important. But more people actually die of heart failure. And more people with heart failure will be having other conditions that we will need to care for as well. So we need to be skilling ourselves up and not feel frightened by that. And we're frightened when we don't know enough about it. So we have a responsibility to learn about how to provide the best possible care. And then the last thing to say is that, as what Eve said, is we just need to keep going. We need to make sure that end-of-life care remains high on the agenda of politicians and high on the agenda of the National Commissioning Board and the clinical commissioning groups, because they're the people who obviously have the money, and money is important in enabling us to deliver high-quality care. One of the reasons the Nuffield work, I think, is so important is it will demonstrate clearly to commissioners that high-quality care in the best interests of the patients can be cheaper. And in the current economic environment, that's really important. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.